You're listening to Tech Talk Radio in your backyard and worldwide on the pod.
Every once in a while, a revolutionary product comes along that changes everything.
Hello, welcome please to Telstra Customer Service. How may I be helping you?
Conform or be consumed.
Today is a very important day in Australia's history.
I heard a rumour today.
I like your rumours.
I know, as a parent, I would often say to my children, you've just spoken to this person for 8 hours at school. How can you sit online and chat to them for another 5 hours?
What is your environmental policy?
To sell Telstra.
You heard of road rage?
Yes.
What about web rage?
And within a few minutes.
Minutes.
Yeah, minutes. It's not next year, mate.
On air, on the internet, and on the pod. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome to the next Tech Talk Radio Summer Series installment. I'm Dr. Ron. Thanks for tuning in. As you know, the Tech Talk Radio crew is currently on holidays, returning live in the first week of Feb. So in the meantime, we're showcasing some program highlights in this entertaining summer series. Now, in this installment, we'll be hearing from Thomas Robinson from popular internet service provider Web Central. Tom spoke to us about web hosting and web page design. Also, I was lucky enough to interview Oscar Trimboli last year. Oscar works for Microsoft Australia, and he told us about the new unified communications products now on offer. Friend of the panel, David Yarmouni, dropped in on our 150th episode in 2007 with his very own brand spanking new iPhone, which still had the plastic protector on the screen from memory. It was that new. We'll also be hearing from another longtime friend of the panel, Robert Broomhead from the Wireless Institute of Australia. Robert came into Tech Talk Radio to discuss the intriguing hobby of amateur radio. I'm Dr. Ron. You'll be hearing from me again a bit later, but there's lots to get through. For now, on with the show.
The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
The wonderful world of web. Dr. Ron introduced us to the very, very first website back in what,
1991.
Wow. That's very impressive. Well, today, 100 million of the suckers floating around the place. You've got to put them somewhere.
And they look a little different to that first website.
Hosting is what we call it in the game, where a company that specialises in being connected to the internet will always be there for you, and they'll always serve your web page out to anyone that wants to have a look at it. There's many companies out there that do it, from local homegrown companies through to the foreign nationals. Now, there are pros and cons of doing things offshore, pros and cons of doing things here at home too. But at the end of the day, you need to choose the package that best suits you. One of the downsides in Australia, I would have to say, would be bandwidth, because of the nature of our government and what they've delivered to us in respect to fraud band, as we've been calling it of recent times here. Whereas you look at some of the other countries over the other side of the world, and they're just giving it away. You know, too much bandwidth, not a problem. Away you go. So depending upon what you're doing, you would choose the appropriate sort of hosting
package.
Company.
Yeah. Yeah, if you're expecting an enormous amount of traffic, then you probably look at having it hosted offshore, just because, as Andrew said, of the sheer size of the internet connection.
Would depend on whether most of your traffic's going to be... If most of your traffic's coming from Australia, then you'd host it in Australia.
But if it was mainly from offshore, then you'd probably host it offshore, Graham. Yeah.
That's what I would have thought.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. Anyway, we have
an expert here.
Our guest in this evening, who's going to tell us all about these sort of things, from Web Central, one of the largest companies in town. They're not the only company, but one of the largest ones. Thomas Robinson. Very good evening to you, Tom.
Hello.
Thank you very much for coming in on Cup Eve and all that sort of stuff.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about the hosting company. It's sort of grown in recent times, hasn't it? Obviously, since day one, when Dr. Ron was talking about the first website through to what we've got now. Domain names have been sort of... Well, there used to be a lot of suppliers of those things, and they're sort of becoming a little bit more consolidated these days. And you guys are actually, in fact, teaming up with probably Australia's most well-known domain registrar, aren't you? Or
yes.
If you haven't already.
Yes, they're quite large, actually. They're the fifth largest registrar in the world, so the size is absolutely massive.
And we're talking Melbourne IT here for those that haven't quite worked it out.
Yes, that's correct. Most of their business is primarily done over in the States, but they certainly do have a lot of... market share here in Australia.
So tell us a little bit about web hosting and respect to the different packages that you've got from, let's go from individual through to large businesses. What would you recommend, or what would you talk to customers about firstly to try and work out what they needed?
First of all, I'd need to work out how important the internet is to them for their business. Some businesses don't really need a a massive website that that has a lot of bells and whistles. They might just need a brochure style website. Once I've worked out how important it is, the sorts of features, you know, how much space they need, what sort of site it's going to be. Is it going to be a shopping sort of a site, e-commerce, or is it going to be something that is advertising a particular service that they have? Stuff like that.
Okay. So you're looking at basically what you would call server space for the size of a website. So based on the number of pages that they would have, and throw into that mix the actual requirements, as in shopping center, as you just said, look at the technology that they would need to put on their site.
That's right. A website, I wish it was very simple, but when you're selling things online, there's lots of ways you can go about it. Sometimes you have to run a database because you've got all of these products, you've got thousands of products. Other times you don't have to run a database. There's also scripting languages and all sorts of stuff like that. So for the person that's never really gone down that path before, it can be quite difficult in determining what they have to do. So part of my job is to work with web developers and also customers and help them get web-enabled with their business.
The technology has gone forward in leaps and bounds of recent time, especially with the major providers. Well, what are they? There's Microsoft, which provide what we call IIS, which is their homegrown web-serving technology. There's Apache, which is a Linux-based technology. There's probably a couple of other ones out there too, wouldn't there? Well, I don't know whether there's anything that's traditionally Mac or anything like that, but
Probably 98 or 99% of the world's web servers you just mentioned there in two or three products, I think, Andrew.
Exactly.
I'd say Tom will probably tell us that most of your stuff's hosted on Apache systems, are they, or Unix-based systems?
No, actually, we're primarily a Windows-based provider.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, we work very closely with Microsoft in with their platforms and web-enabling some of their software as well.
So do you use Internet Information Server, or IIS, as Andrew mentioned?
That's correct.
Yeah? Okay.
Yeah. We do, yes.
Now, IIS, for those of you who know, if you've written any languages like Visual Basic, is traditionally a Microsoft language, it ports quite nicely onto an IIS box or a Microsoft box. Just seems to work. That's my upbringing anyway, in particular, from that sort of technology.
Also, technologies like PHP and so on that are traditionally thought of as being Linux world type of technologies.
Where did PHP come from? That's personal homepage is what it stands for, isn't it?
It's a scripting language. It's just a different way of doing server side scripting as compared with ASP, which is the Microsoft way.
I think it stands for PHP hype something parser. It's a strange recursive acronym. It doesn't make any sense. The first P of PHP stands for PHP.
Yeah,
hypertext parser or something strange.
But the point was that even on a Microsoft server, we'll still run PHP type web pages, won't it?
That's right.
You have to run.
You have
to load up PHP.
You're not limiting yourself.
Yeah, I think you have to load it up on your web box, though, on your server. It's not out of the box on IIS. Oh, it might be in the new stuff. It might be.
You look, there's a massive market out there for both systems, as you said before. And we run PHP and MySQL on our Windows boxes simply because there's developers out there in the world that are saying you should go down this path. And customers come to us and say, can you host this? And we have the best of both worlds.
Let's talk a little bit about bandwidth. How would you describe bandwidth to a person that says, well, I want to put my site up and I don't know what to do? What's bandwidth?
Good question. Bandwidth is something that you need to be conscious of if you're planning quite a popular site.
On the spreadsheet, it's called monthly data transfer if you're looking at web hosting companies for this sort of technology.
That's right. So if you're going to have a particularly popular website, bandwidth, as I said, is something that you need to look at, and that's basically the amount of times that someone's or a group or whoever your customer is looking at a particular page on your website or your whole website or a video or a sound file. So this is all bandwidth that's being used in serving that page or that item out to the person that's looking at it through their browser.
If you're on an ADSL plan, Tom, and maybe you have 8 gigabytes per month that you can use, that might be a fairly standard plan that we have in Australia. You might find if you're hosting video on a website, you could churn through 8 gigabytes in a day, couldn't you, if you had a lot of people visiting a website.
We do, with the podcast.
Mm. Well, we churn through a lot of bandwidth, don't we?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's why it's in the United States, because we, I think, 11 gig or higher sometimes when we put the podcast
up. Yeah. So you'd look, discuss with your customers, Tom, in regards to what their requirements are and what they're going to actually be serving on their home pages or their web pages.
That's
and
right.
And you can recommend to them what the best options are.
That's right. And look, it can be a hard question. A customer can say, well, this is the site, and I can turn around and say, well, how much traffic are you expecting? And they turn around and say, well, how long is a piece of string, really? It depends how the customer is going to, once again, are they going to market the site through other medians? Are they going to use some sort of email campaign or the radio, for instance, or television? So bandwidth is one of the important key factors.
Well, with bandwidth, there's two things to bear in mind as well. There's the total amount of data that's going to be moved over the course of a month, but there's also the peak amount of usage. If you're going to move, you could move the same amount of data over a week, or you could move that same amount of data if everybody went to your website at the same time. Like if you had an advertisement on TV that had your website on it, and everybody went there at the same time, you'd want to have a big enough pipe that you could. That it wouldn't slow down, even if that amount of data was nowhere near your total monthly allocation.
That's right. So I guess that's a good point. So if you're choosing a host provider where you just need to be careful in the way that if you get a lot of traffic at any one given time, it could impact on your site, or it could be another customer that's on that server that you're with a host provider.
It's what we call a shared server, isn't it?
That's right.
With shared servers, how many clients would share on a box? Are we talking tens, hundreds, thousands?
Really depends. Once again, how long is a piece of string? But generally speaking, with some of your quality host providers, they won't have too many customers on there. Mm-hmm. And the reason why they do that is because if you've got a bunch, let's say you've got 1,000 customers on one box, and you've got another scenario, we've got 500. You're obviously going to expect more traffic, well, theoretically anyway, to a box with 1,000 customers on it as opposed to 500. So if someone else has got a heavy traffic site, or let's say 100 of those people have got heavy traffic sites, it may impact the performance of your website, in which case people will be trying to look at pages on your website and they may not be coming up.
One of the words in the brochures, or I guess where you look for choosing a site, is load balancing. Is this what we're talking about here?
Load balancing is another way of actually ensuring that your site is available, and that's another conversation, I guess. Load balancing is for those sites that are expecting a high amount of traffic, in which what will happen is your site will be on two different servers, so it will share the traffic between these two servers, thus allowing you higher throughput to your website.
Does that mean two different servers at the same place, or might those two different servers be connected in physically different locations in the
different
world?
They could be, either or, for redundancy. Just in case something happens to that building, there could be a power outage, there could be a fire. That, once again, that's another thing that you could, if you could be expecting high traffic, is something you'd look into.
And your network would be able to do that in such a way that the user gets a seamless experience no matter which web server the page is coming from.
Yep, spot on. We have two data centers in Queensland, and that's for geographical redundancy, and we have a bunch of links, and so do other companies. They have much the same thing, and once again, just to switch over, just in the event that something does happen.
Looking other sort of requirements of a web hosting packages is email. The technical word, I guess, is POP mailboxes, Post Office Protocol mailboxes. Tell us a little bit about those. Obviously, email's the scourge of the world when it comes to spam at the moment. Should you look for things like spam filtering, or is the attitude of a company like Web Central to say, well, we provide you the tools, it's up to you to use them if you want to use them? Because this is a contentious issue at the moment.
I think spam's a big thing in everyone's vocabulary. Anyone that accesses the internet is well aware of it, and Web Central does provide an anti-spam tool, and so do other companies as a default now. It's just something that we need to live with, I guess, and something that's being policed, but is very hard to control. But definitely, email is really important to businesses these days. It's replacing faxes, and interruption by spam is definitely a decrease in productivity. I think if you were to measure it out, it's quite substantial over a period of a year. So anti-spam tools are a must with any host provider, and that's something that businesses should be looking for.
What sort of anti-spam tools do you use?
We have our own. We as I understand, before Melbourne IT acquired Web Central, purchased a company called MessageCare, and MessageCare developed a an anti-spam tool themselves, and we continue to develop that tool.
Okay, cool. Spam being the scourge of the industry as we're speaking, 80 to 90%, we were told a couple of weeks ago, is spam in the Australian workplace. Does that upset you guys in respect to it costing a lot of money in bandwidth, or do you block it before it does cost you bandwidth?
I don't know the intricacies of our anti-spam tool, but I do know that it does have an impact. It does take, our staff have to manage it, and they have to make sure that basically the latest emails are... filtered, for better of a word. They're called honeypots, actually. I don't want to get too technical, but basically, if one person is to receive a spam item and they flag that as spam, for instance, might have a keyword of Viagra in it, but that would be normally picked up automatically. Let's use that as an instance. Basically, we manage the honeypots actually allow us to roll that email out across our whole customer base, so that if one person flags it as spam, well, nobody else is going to get it. They don't have to worry about receiving it.
That's good. Let's move on and talk about things like building a website. If you have no idea how to build a website, you have a little thing to help people come along for the first time called Site Builder. I think a lot of web hosting companies tend to do this these days, and out of the box type, sort of choose a template and off you go. Is that pretty much how it works?
It is. It's for someone that's running a small business and doesn't quite have the budget to actually develop a website. So it's quite simple. It's web-based, no need to install any software, and basically you actually provide the content and upload your content, choose your actual layout. It's very simple to use.
So it's all done with a web browser, is it, Tom? So you don't need to install any software on your computer at home.
That's right. It's made to be as simple as possible for a small business.
That's terrific.
For a business setting up their first website, that'd be a good way to sort of work out what sort of things they need, so that when they can go to the next level and then, you know, work out, I need this part of the site to be better, so I'll get a web developer to build something customised for me. But to get something up quickly and learn which areas are going to be useful to a particular business, it's a good way to start, isn't it?
It certainly is. It's a good first step.
So if you've got your domain name, or even if you haven't got your domain name, we can come through an organisation such as yours and say, okay, here I am, I want to register abcdef.com or .com.au. And within how long would it take for someone to get that registered and to be online with their website and have an email address, for example?
Provided they've already developed their website or they're looking to use this web builder tool that you talked about before, within 24 hours.
So that's pretty good. So if you've got a campaign you want to run in a newspaper or you need a web presence and you want to do it all yourself, 24 hours. And what are the sort of costs involved in a simple sort of small business site like that, where they do choose to come along and use the site builder, for example, to do that? What would they be looking at?
Oh, they're looking around about $40 per month. So it's not a big cost to a business.
Yep. And then that way the business is accessible 24/7 from anywhere in the world.
Correct, that's right.
And they have all the mailboxes and things like that to go with it. So want to talk about databases. This is moving to the next level. Let's say, for example,
we're getting technical now, Andrew.
We are getting a little bit technical.
We need to touch on it, though.
We do, exactly right. A lot of organisations have a database of products that they would like to sell. Now, databases sort of traditionally are pretty ugly things, as Dr. Ron sort of instantly went on the back foot there and said, oh, here we go.
The whole world of pain.
What are there? There's two sort of types of databases. There's access databases and there's sort of SQL type sort of things, aren't they? Anyway, tell us a bit about how the data works. Is it really as a nightmare as it sort of seems, or is there an easy way to sort of approach an online sort of categorizing of products?
Well, for the beginner, I wouldn't recommend it.
The advanced, I wouldn't recommend it.
Yeah, well, it can get quite difficult.
Well said.
This is where you need to get a professional web developer involved, isn't it?
That's right. Or there are applications out there that will actually build a database for you and give you an e-commerce presence.
The sort of thing we're talking about probably is, say, if I had a list of 1,000 products and I wanted a customer to be able to go to my website and just type in a name or part of a name of the product and click look it up, a button or something like that, and just to have it, the web page come back and return a price, for example, or a part number or something like that. So something fairly simple. It's something that you'd be able to help set up at Web Central? Or?
That's right. We could refer a customer to a web developer to help them get onto the web with that. So,
because you guys don't do that, do you? You specialise in what you do, hosting
correct.
Websites.
Yeah, we just host. We want to be the best at what we do, and we just host. That's all we're interested in.
That's
doing.
That's a good way to be.
Yeah.
There's a lot of talk about uptime. Let's use some lingo here. Everyone has SLAs, a service level agreement.
Yes.
Sort of traditionally becoming a bit of a thing of the past, I think, in the competitive world that we're at. And a lot of people say, well, if you think of a 99.9% uptime, what does that work out to being? Probably maybe 4 or 5 hours in a month or something like that?
Well, I know that from experience, people talk about 5 nines, 99.999% uptime. If you do the sums, that's a 5 minute downtime a year.
A year.
Mm. So you can allow 5 minutes downtime to maybe do a critical hardware change or a reboot for some reason. But for the rest of the year, that system has to be up and running. And probably large corporates would be expecting 5 nines uptime, wouldn't they, on their production systems?
Definitely. We can give them all the nines they want. They just have to pay for it.
Time is money.
But that's just exactly right. You get what you pay for.
You do.
So if you come in off the street and you buy a standard package, say one of the ones you were speaking about before, $40 a month, what sort of guarantees are you going to get from a hosting company that it's going to be there when they need it? I'd say pretty good, just a guess.
Well, it is good, but there's no guarantee that the service is going to be there with our $40 package. If you're looking for something like that, then you're talking something a bit more expensive. You're talking over $400 or $500 per month. And SLAs, you're right, only generally appeal to corporates. But these days, as you may know, hardware is pretty reliable. Network uptime is generally pretty reliable, especially when you've got more than one provider. So SLAs, yeah, they're generally in the back of most people's minds. It only comes into play when they're looking for their ADSL or something like that. But hosting generally is not an issue for the small business.
Exactly. Exactly. Now, it's a bit of a minefield, all that sort of stuff, having dealt with some organisations that are fairly quick off the mark to give you a call when their website goes down. And let's just face it, all of the guys sitting in the studio tonight, we all know what computers are like. They do. They just stop for no apparent reason from time to time.
And if you look at it from the point of view of a large corporate, a five-minute downtime on a website, Tom, that could be thousands and thousands, tens, hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of lost revenue or lost productivity if their customers can't access their page. If you're talking about a large airline, for example, and thousands of people around the world can't make bookings or whatever for a period of time, then it certainly becomes a very serious problem from a commercial concern, doesn't
but
it?
But it certainly does.
Not so much a problem for the small company with a brochure-type site. So.
That's right, yeah.
But then again, the large aviation company would have the budget to
build that into such a sort of state. Exactly right. So you've got very differing extremes, haven't you?
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio. The panel tonight is Graham Callaghan and Dr. Ron and myself. And we've got Tom Robinson in from Web Central. We're talking all about web hosting and all those sort of interesting little things that you need to know. And we'll be back with more in just a moment.
There's a level of ignorance out there which isn't acceptable. Mm.
Didn't John Howard drop past to get permission to call an election?
What did you use before NextG for data?
iBurst. The screen is actually a lot larger than any of the previous iPod models.
We've spoken before about the trade-off between usability and security.
Apple have been accused of an unlawful monopoly.
No, say it's not true.
You're listening to Australia's most informative technology show.
You know, here we go again.
Tech Talk Radio.
Homer, Bill Gates is here.
Bill Gates? Billionaire computer nerd Bill Gates?
Your internet ad was brought to my attention, but I can't figure out what, if anything, Compia Global Hyper MegaNet does. So rather than risk competing with you, I've decided simply to buy you out.
The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
And that's Google's attitude these days to anyone that comes anywhere near.
I don't suppose you host Compia Global Hyper MegaNet, do you?
You beat me to it, Graham.
Dear. Now, you're listening to Tech Talk Radio. Joining us on the panel this evening is Thomas Robinson from Web Central, Australia's largest web hosting company. And we've been asking more interesting questions. If you're running a small business, how do you do it? Why do you do it? Where do you do it? And things like that. What we're going to ask now is a little bit about security and statistics, because if you are running a campaign either through the press or through anything really, you want to know how many people come to your website, how many people click on the page, which is actually what you're trying to advertise, and follow them up, I guess, in a lot of respects. So, Thomas, tell us a bit about stats packages. How important are they, and are some better than others?
Stats, I think, are pretty important. If you're going to host a website, it's all good and well having it out there on the web, but you need to measure how effective it is. And statistics allow you to do that. You look at pages, you get a breakdown. Where are people coming from? Are they coming from a search engine to look at your website? What pages are they looking at? Where are they landing? And what sort of products are they clicking through to have a look at? And stats will allow you to modify your sites in a way that it may actually make it more successful.
Tom, how and when are the statistics generated? Is it automatically your systems create a web page so that you go to a reports page, for example, something like that, and you can see on the fly what sort of traffic is being attracted to your site?
That's right. It's live data. So as it's happening, it's there within the stats package. And basically, you've got more information than what you need, really, with most packages these days. As I said before, there's a lot of information in there that allows you to look at how effective your website has been.
And Web Central provides a stats package with all the hosting packages or a choice of stats packages? Or
We have a default offering with all of our hosting plans amongst many value-added sort of services.
Very good.
Because I think not all web stats packages are the same. You want to know, I think we touched on just before, where they're coming from, whether they're coming from Australia or offshore, whether they're coming from Google, for example, whether they're coming from directly just typing in your name into the web browser. All very important things, and especially if you're running an advertising campaign, you can only measure the cost effectiveness on that campaign by how the phone is ringing or how many click-throughs you've had to your website. And if you put your head in the sand about that, well, how are you going to know?
And you can see hour by hour and minute by minute as well, can't you? So if a commercial goes to air on local television, for example, you can actually see almost down to the minute a huge spike in traffic or not, and you can determine whether or not that part of your advertising campaign is effective.
It even goes one further. You can actually see who's looking at your website at that particular given moment. So that's some really awesome sort of stuff.
What, as you said, names and addresses?
Well, just about. No, it actually tells you, the ISP that they're coming from, but... Yeah, you can have a look at how many people are actually on the site there and then. So if you're running a TV campaign or radio campaign, it's quite effective.
So you can see a dynamic, like a snapshot of that point in time, how many people are actually have just looked at my website.
That's right.
Isn't that fantastic?
Yeah. It's definitely what you need as an advertiser to be able to see that sort of stuff. Now, let's talk a little bit about, connectivity. We sort of take, for example, an ADSL connection, as you mentioned earlier on this evening, Dr. Ron. I suspect Web Central's just got a tad faster than an ADSL connection.
You've got more than the 1.5 meg connection?
Just a little. Yeah, just a little.
You've got a few of those.
A few of those, yeah.
So what sort of connections do you use?
We have massive cables connecting us to telco providers, and they're 100 megabit connections and 1,000 megabit connections. And we've got a bunch of those for failover. So in the event that some poor soul digs up a cable or one of the cables fails, then we can intelligently switch the data over to the other connection.
One gigabit is enormous.
Sorry, one megabit.
One megabit?
Yeah.
Is that like with optic fiber, or what sort of hardware is involved with that stuff? Do you know?
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I don't know. All I know is that they're massive pipes that are nowhere near their capability.
That's good. They've got plenty of headroom then if they're nowhere near their capability.
For growth, that's good.
That's right.
Now, what about ISPs? I use that term because that's what everyone's used to knowing. Do you use different providers, or do you solely use one provider to provide this great connectivity?
Good point. We use a bunch of different providers here in Australia, and that's a good thing because if you've got your site with us and someone's going through someone like Telstra or Optus, then they've basically got just about a direct connection to our data center, which means the pages are going to load quite fast.
Mm-hmm. And that would also give you a level of redundancy as well, Tom. So if there is a technical difficulty with one particular path into your organisation, then you've got other paths as well, technically, which you can rely on.
That's right. Another provider. So totally different network, which is good for failover.
But all web hosting companies would do the same thing, surely? They'd have multiple telcos?
Some of them do. Some of them out there only have one connection to the internet. So if that connection's to go down, all of their customers' websites are no longer
really
available.
Really? So you'd want to be careful about choosing one that had lots of different connectivity.
Definitely, it's an important factor if you're looking at really driving business through your website.
It's interesting, really, because not too many web hosting companies actually talk about their connectivity. They'll tell you how fast, but they won't tell you how they actually connect.
Probably the ones that don't say much about it will be the ones that have got a single provider.
That's right. And it's up to you as the business owner to ask these questions.
Lastly, this evening, network integrity is a pretty interesting thing. We all run personal firewalls on our computers at home to stop people coming in and running nasty code on our systems. You guys are connected to the internet like we are. You must surely have some interesting procedures and software in place to make sure that someone who either unknowingly or knowingly uploads some code on their website, which you know might be a page counter, could be anything which they load up as a third-party application that is not written by you guys. How do you monitor that for exploitation or someone coming in to do the wrong thing, I guess?
First of all, we ensure that we have a strict security policy. And second of all, we monitor the environment. So we have a bunch of different tools that allow us to monitor the environment 24/7. Other host providers do this as well. It's very important that we monitor the service, because if there's one customer affecting a bunch of others, then we need to stop that activity. The policies that we enforce are generally strict, but still allow you to be quite flexible with the type of website you've got. And at the end of the day, make a more secure environment for other people.
Because when we're load sharing, for want of a better term, with other customers, you wouldn't want to be on the same server that someone who uploaded some malicious code on, because it could either grab your information, I guess, if it steals data, but whatever it might happen to do. So it's a fairly sort of onerous task, really, isn't it? Mm. You really have to make sure that everything's working properly.
That's right. It's important that the environment's locked down to a certain extent to prevent the use or the accidental use of someone else's data.
Mm. Thomas, it's been a very enlightening and insightful view on web hosting this evening. I think we've put a lot of interesting sort of questions, which I think everyone can now use to make a educated decision when they're choosing a hosting company. Thanks heaps for your time this evening, and hopefully, Graham, one more question.
Oh, no, just what's your website so that we can go and have a look at what's offered?
Webcentral.com.au.
Oh, you'd Absolutely. Never guess, would you?
It's an easy one. Very good.
It's a good one. So, yeah, plenty of options there, and go and have a look at. And if you have any questions for us, feel free. feedback@techtalkradio.com.au. You can go visit the website and send one through from there, or on air if you just want to use your mail client. On air at techtalkradio.com.au. We'll be back with more in just a moment. How easy is it to generate 100 points without photo ID these days?
Elections must cost the economy millions, hundreds of millions of dollars in lost productivity.
So is the coverage any better? That's the million-dollar question.
There's also a new patch for the iPhone.
Please read the screens as you click next, next, next.
Why? We've never had it before.
And people are stupid. I've said it once, I'll say it again.
I'll listen.
You're listening to Australia's most informative technology show, Tech Talk Radio. The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
Now, Dr. Ron, unified messaging. You've played with it in a professional capacity. Is there any future for it?
Yeah, there is. Unified messaging is extremely exciting. It's been around for a long time now, but we're starting to see more and more systems become more and more tightly integrated.
If you could describe it in a sentence, what is unified messaging?
Well, unified messaging is the ability to access any of your messages from any interface.
Okay, so if I'm on my mobile phone, I can check an email.
Correct. If you're at your computer and you've got your email client running, you can check your faxes or listen to your voicemail messages.
Can you listen to a fax? That'd be tricky.
You can't listen to a fax. You can view it.
Okay.
If you're on a telephone, yeah, for example, and you want to see a fax, you can forward it to a fax machine. Or ooh, you can forward it to an email address. Say that you're traveling interstate and you're in a motel, and you check your voicemail and it says, you've got a new fax message. I think, damn, well, I better check that. So you should be able to forward it.
Obsolete concept, really, well, is when you think about it. A lot of people use it still.
A lot of fax equipment out there, Andrew. So you can forward that message to a fax machine at the motel, or you could even forward it to an email address, and you could then check it on your email.
And this is where you can get a fax to your mobile phone these days. A lot of service providers actually allow you to do that, don't they? And it gets stored and forwarded somewhere?
Exactly. That's exactly right. Now, the extension of unified messaging is unified communications. And I spoke with Microsoft's Oscar Trimboli about unified communications and the way in which you can be at any device, whether you're at your computer or your telephone, your mobile phone, your desk phone, logged into a Skype client or internet messaging, and you can receive any of your telephone calls, incoming calls, to any device.
Do you reckon Microsoft are going to nail this? Because this is new for them, isn't it? Have they been dabbling in...
It's very new. I think they are definitely on the right track. The challenge with unified messaging and unified communications comes where you're wanting to integrate computer systems with other types of hardware. And in the
What about Outlook and stuff like that? Does it do that?
Well, it does, but they've got a handle on Outlook, and people understand Outlook. Where it becomes a challenge is where you want to connect your Exchange server to a Fujitsu PABX, or what the Americans would call a PBX system, or you want to connect your Lotus Notes Domino server to an Alcatel phone system, for example. And this sort of integration is really a very specialist field.
Okay. Well, let's have a listen and see what you came up with. What was he saying?
This is Oscar Trimboli from Microsoft.
Recently, I spoke with Oscar Trimboli, the director of Microsoft's Unified Communications Business Group in Australia and New Zealand. While unified messaging has been around for some time, enabling voice, email, and fax access from any device, Unified Communications extends this model to incoming call control. When a customer dials your office telephone number, Microsoft's new Unified Communications server can make an intelligent decision about how to handle the call, based on the number that's been dialed, the time of day, what's in your Outlook calendar, or even based on who's calling. Can you start by telling us, for those listeners who don't know, what is Unified Communications?
Unified Communications is, a very simply putting, people and not devices at the centre of the communication process, so that when you contact somebody, you're contacting a person. You don't have to figure out, should I call their mobile, should I send them an email? The system will figure that out for you and be smart enough to know if they're in a meeting to get them on the right device.
So this sounds almost like a call control type system. It recognises where a person is or what device they're on or available on, and it directs the call that way. So do you advertise like one number?
Look, the choices you give people to contact you are up to you. So I'll use me as a simple example. On my business card, I only have one telephone number, and I have my email address. But I think at the end of the day, my reason for doing that is I want to give people a choice how they choose to contact me. So we don't want to be prescriptive and say people have to go and use one number. The systems are smart enough today to know and work out, based on systems like your calendar, when you're available and what the right method is. So if your calendar says you're out of the office, then obviously the best place to send that call is to the mobile phone and not to the desk phone. And the systems are smart enough to figure that out now.
There's two new products, Office Communication Server and Office Communicator 2007. Can you give us a bit of an overview as to the differences between those two products?
Office Communication Server is a third generation product that we just released, in fact, last Thursday. So it was a great milestone. It combines web conferencing, video conferencing, instant messaging, and telephony systems all into one place, so that you can just click to call, you can click to instant message, you can click to set up a video conference. And the Office Communicator 2007 sits on your PC or your mobile phone or a web browser, and it enables you to connect back to the server and do all the functionality that you that I just mentioned.
So like Office Communicator 2007, that's like the client side of the environment, is it? And the communication server's the actual backroom server that runs and controls all this technology?
That's it. You've got it. One's for the backroom and the server and the IT department, and the Communicator 2007 is for the end user and the client. The PC is the way most people experience that.
In terms of integrating with an existing system, it might be a Microsoft house and I've got Microsoft products in place already, like an Exchange server or something like that. Does Office Communication Server assume the role of one of the existing systems? How does it fit together?
At the core of all these systems is the directory service called Active Directory, which is part of Windows Server, and that understands both the Exchange server and the Office Communication server, so it pulls those together. You don't have to think about pulling that together yourself. The systems do that automatically. But the important thing is that playing by yourself in Unified Communications isn't the full story. Unified Communications has to be a broad ecosystem of people across telecommunications carriers, PABX providers and video conferencing providers, and systems integration partners and hosters And Microsoft doesn't do all of that. So we say unified communications needs an ecosystem that pulls all that together so that you can work with all various types of PABXs like Nortel and Avaya and Alcatel and Cisco and Mitel.
That's a very good point, because part of the unified communications concept is that you're combining all of the different communicating technologies, if you like. And if I've got a substantial investment in an NEC PABX or an Ericsson phone system or Cisco or Nortel or Fujitsu, one of those ones like you mentioned, I want to make sure that if I'm going to invest in the Microsoft products, that it's going to integrate well and integrate tightly and provide a seamless interface.
Yeah, and I spend a lot of time going and visiting customers with those other vendors, and the customers basically say, look, we've got a big investment in you, and we've got a big investment with another provider. We're not throwing out either of them. We want them to work together. You two guys figure out how to bring that together for us, and we're doing more and more and more of that at a software level for both our side and the other side.
In this world where we're all driven by budgets and cost saving and having to look at the most cost-effective way of doing things a lot of the time, as a manager, if I'm implementing a system like this, do I need to look at buying proprietary Microsoft hardware or handsets or anything like that? Or can I use, apart from the existing infrastructure we spoke about before, like telephone handsets, can I use a sound card in my PC, in my headset, or do I have to buy Microsoft hardware?
Look, absolutely. You can. You've got a total range of choices there, from Bluetooth headset devices through to USB-based headsets and microphones, through to your existing telephone that you use today.
So that can just be generic equipment, Oscar, that they've already got that's like USB compliant or whatever.
Yeah, look, a couple of folks I was talking about were literally saying, you know, this stuff you can get from Harris Technology or one of Officeworks or those kind of providers.
I mean, we've come from like 10 or 15 years ago where we had to buy, you know, proprietary handsets and things for employees' desktops, and that's where they always used to sting you in terms of budget. But now if we've got it like down to a commodity level where you can just buy things that you plug into your PC, like a USB headset or microphone, it's going to make it a much easier prospect, isn't it, to roll it out?
Yeah, and that's, you know, for home-based scenarios, you know, those simple things. But if you've already made that investment in the hardware in your office, then why throw it out? It works perfectly well and it's integrated, so keep it there.
Yeah, absolutely. Office Communication Server, there's an enterprise version and a standard version. Can you give us a quick rundown of the differences between the two?
Really simply, one for relatively smaller organisations and one for a really large organisation with complex disaster recovery scenarios.
Where can we go to find out more about these products if we're interested in introducing them into a business or an enterprise?
Sure, there's two places I would say to go if you want to learn about products specifically. It's microsoft.com/UC for Unified Communications. And if you want to learn about what's happening in the Australian market, we've got a blog that we talk about specific Australian customers, leaders in the unified communications industry, and that's blogs.msdn.com/OscarTR.
Thanks very much for your time today, Oscar. I know you're extremely busy, but we really appreciate you talking to us on Tech Talk Radio and giving us an overview about Microsoft's new unified communications products.
Thanks, Ron. Have a good day.
Listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Well, that covers the office side of things, but what about the home user sort of thing? I think it's a bit beyond home users, and you'd have to be a fairly sophisticated sort of home user, wouldn't you?
You would. The new Unified Communication Server is specifically designed for small businesses, small to medium enterprises, but if you're a home user...
Well, like what? Like five people in your business or something and they're on the road? Is that sort of where it's targeted?
Well, if you had a small business with five people on the road, I think it would be ideal because there's a scaled-down version, as Oscar said. And, I mean, it'd be great because it would free you from actually needing to be at your office. It would free you from needing to go to the office to press a call divert button or a call forward button on your telephone, which all of us are familiar with. You go out of the office and you think, damn, I didn't divert my phone or I didn't hit that call forward button.
Oh, all the time.
But with this sort of technology, you can log in with a web browser and you can redirect your calls. You can log in with the web browser and say, I want every call to go to voicemail, but any call from Andrew or Graham or Mark, I want to come through to my mobile. So you've got this flexibility with like a rule-based system where you can send your calls.
Very interesting. Well, interesting to watch this space and see what happens with it, because I think you got to. It's an interesting. You've got to get the culture right in the office for these sort of things, because, like our office, there's the tech savvy and there's the not so tech savvy. A bit like the home environment in a lot of respects, isn't it? Sort of.
Look, it's not for everybody, and I'd say have a look at the product and what it offers. But for people who maybe have a sales department, they're sales driven, or they've got separate sales or technical support groups, things like that, it might be very useful.
Listening to Tech Talk Radio.
And welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. Joining the full contingency of the panel this evening is an old friend of mine, David Jarmouni, who's the first person I know to buy, to collect, to steal. I don't know how you got it, David, but there is now an iPhone sitting on the bench here in the studio at Tech Talk Radio. And it works!
It does indeed.
How does it work? What did you do? Yeah, do tell.
Okay, well, as any of you who've been following the iPhone story, there's been quite a long saga and a long history that goes with it. But just briefly, basically, iPhone was released with two software revisions. Well, actually a few more, but the main ones that we're interested are in 1.02.
Now, these are software versions, are they? Yeah.
Yeah, and they also changed the firmware when they went to 1.1.1.
I'm sorry.
1.1.1's the release that's just been hacked.
That's correct.
In the last week?
Yes. Yes.
And you've got 1.1.1 in this device?
No, I haven't actually. This is still a 1.02.
Okay.
So I haven't done the Intrepid upgrade. I'm just going to wait until everything is completely ironed out.
All the dust settles.
Smart man.
Yes. And free.
Now, you're one of these people which has still got the plastic on the front of it, so that speaks volumes in a lot of respect.
Like my grandmother's couch.
Yes. At least I'm not a 12 o'clock flasher where all my clocks are still flashing 12 o'clock. So I have to leave the plastic on there just for the time being.
David, does it meet your expectations? Is it what you expected to find when you opened it up in the parcel today?
Absolutely. I just about passed out. It was fantastic. I just took it out and I said, I have an iPhone. I'm excited about it, and it's wonderful. And it works exactly as I'd hoped it would. It connected to my wireless network without any trouble whatsoever. Connected once I did all the relevant hacks.
How long did it take you to do the hacks? And could anyone do them?
Okay. Now, yes is the answer, but they'd have to be either very patient or very willing. If you're a bit faint-hearted, I wouldn't recommend going down the path of hacking an iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
Even though all the software is readily available, free, and all GUI-driven, so it's all graphical now. There's no more command lines or shell scripts or stuff.
Did you have to do any hardware changes to the device?
The only hardware change I had to do was cut a hole so that I could actually hear in the plastic, so that I could hear the speaker and change the SIM, so that I could actually use it on Optus Network here.
Right.
Sorry, that was you had to cut a hole in the plastic. What, you can't
hear
it?
Because plastic, this, yeah, because
that's because you want to keep the plastic on.
That's the plastic he doesn't want to take off it.
So, of course, I want it to stay as virginal as possible.
Oh, you mean that plastic? The piece
that
of
plastic.
So you want to remove when you get it.
Yeah, that
that's
one.
Right. So,
well, that's okay, because there were some early modifications which required you to do hardware changes. You had to get the soldering iron out and have a very steady hand, but now they've sussed out how to do it just with software.
That's correct, yeah.
So what won't your iPhone do that an iPhone would do on AT&T in the US?
The only function that won't work is a function that AT&T use called visual voicemail. And what that is you know how you get voicemail messages? People ring you up, they leave a message. And you think, yep, I've got 7 of them, and I want to listen to number 4. Well, normally you can't do that. You have to listen to...
You have to press skip 4 times or whatever.
Or whatever, you know, whatever your service provider will provide you.
Mm.
With visual voicemail, they appear as messages, just like an instant message dialogue chat. And you just say, I want number 4. And you just tap it, and up it comes. And it plays that message, and you can fast forward it, rewind it, stop at any point.
It sounds like a unified messaging client that's running on the device.
In many respects, it is. It's sort of like, you know, Adium or any one of those sorts of multi-client chat tools.
And so your voicemail sits in your inbox as if it was SMS or email, and you just click on it as if it was any other kind of communication.
Yep, that's exactly right.
But that's not an uncommon way of thinking in this day and age.
No, I do that myself.
Exactly.
I've got a third-party service that converts my voicemail to audio file and emails it to me.
Yeah, yeah. And like if you go with Engine and those sort of guys, they do it all automatically.
Telstra won't, or Optus or any of the main
No. You have to
only
be
nerds like us, won't it?
You have to be small and have the initiative to do that, really, provide certain value adding to your customers. But so, David, yes, you're happy with it out of the box. It looks absolutely fantastic. It's a bit smaller than I actually expected. Well, not having seen one.
I think the thing about the iPhone is, yeah, it's thin, and it's actually not as thin as the iPod Touch. The iPod Touch is actually thinner again.
Now, the difference between the iPod Touch is it doesn't have the phone in it. That's
correct.
Right. It's just...
And also a few other features. So, for example, the iPod Touch at the moment doesn't have email. So when you listen to Steve Jobs talk about these products, he always says, the iPod Touch is an iPod. The iPhone is a phone. He makes a very clear distinction about that all the time. And in all of his news press releases and any live interviews he does, he always talks of the iPhone as being a fantastic phone and the iPod Touch as being a fantastic iPod. So he very clearly separates that functionality. So some of the features, for example, like I said, email in particular, is not available on the iPod Touch, for example. But there's a few extra features on here that, you know, make it... That tie in well with the features of the phone.
Mm. So why would you want an iPod Touch? Am I the only one that doesn't see the point of an iPod Touch?
That's a good question.
Well, look...
I see the point.
Yeah. The iPod Touch still has Wi-Fi. So in many respects... And there are hacks available for it now.
I can see the point.
Wouldn't the iPod Touch be for this market where the iPhone technically isn't available?
But what's it do that an iPod doesn't do besides have Wi-Fi?
Oh, well, it's got the whole touch interface. So it's that
but
touch
you don't
experience.
Do anything with it.
No.
It's a typical Apple product. It's beautiful but useless.
No, it's not.
It's art.
See, you've used that term again.
I had to use that on air. Yeah. It's too good.
No, it's with the iPod Touch, of course, it's basically like an iPhone just without the phone component. So people that don't want, they're happy to keep their phones
separate. They've got a phone. They carry a separate music.
But these people already own an iPod anyway, so why would you switch from an iPod to an iPod Touch?
Well, they might be upgrading. The iPod might have reached its usable life and they need to upgrade, so they're going to get an iPod Touch. They've got a telephone already and they're happy using that as a telephone.
No, sorry, I must have missed something. What's the Touch do that the iPod doesn't?
It's got a touch
interface. It's got a different interface. It doesn't look like an iPod. It looks like that thing sitting in front of you there.
Yeah.
So they want that interface, and they want the ability to have Wi-Fi. They want the ability to make calendar appointments and do all that sort of stuff.
So it's a PDA.
It's a full-on PDA. It's everything except being able to make telephone calls.
Okay, all right. So it's a PDA and an MP3 player, but instead of just being an MP3 player.
And it has a much bigger screen.
Yes.
Ah, yeah. Okay, I can see the value in that. Thank you.
Oh, there you go. So I love my iPhone.
Okay.
It's very fabulous.
And what about usability? Like comparing it to your old phone, is it clearer? Is it better? I must admit when you rang me on it today to say, look what I've got, it was very loud in my ear compared to a lot of other callers that I'd had.
He was just excited.
I think that's probably the case.
One of the things, look, it's still early days. I've only had it for less than 6 hours, so I'm still coming to grips.
You've driven from one side of Melbourne to the other to show us, and we're very grateful for that.
Oh, no, it's my pleasure. One of the things that its text input still leaves a little bit to be desired, but I'm sure with time I'll get used to that.
Mm-hmm.
You can use your thumbs, but it tends to be a little biased. So if you don't hit the key, if you don't hit the onboard representation of the keyboard properly, it'll actually hit the wrong key every time. So you work out a few tricks, like you actually put your finger down and then slide it across to the letter that you want and then let go, and then it'll put the right letter and that sort of stuff.
You'll get the hang of that after a while.
Oh, for sure. The one big drawback, and I don't know if I've not yet investigated this, is it does not read any of my SIM contacts, which is completely useless for me.
So it only uses the phone memory to store details.
Yeah, at this moment in time. So it appears that it ignores, and again, I might be doing something wrong here, but it appears to ignore all the SIM's phone addresses or phone numbers in its address book on the SIM card. So I'm going to have to now export them out of my old phone, massage them, get them in the Apple address book. Mind you, they're all running in Windows at the moment.
But wouldn't you have these already on your... Oh, you're a Windows user at home, are you?
No, well, no. I'm a Mac user, and of course I have an Intel Mac, so of course I'm running virtual machines. So I've got Windows just to do my stupid phone stuff, which is a Sony Ericsson, and of course Windows
but now you don't
do that.
You can, yes.
And now I'll have to export that address book, massage it a little bit, get all my photos out again so that they match the actual addresses again, and then put them in my address book on the Mac and then sync it, and then it should all be happy.
Mm.
I'm hoping.
Mm.
It's going to be another busy day tomorrow, I think.
Yes, I know where you left the plastic on it now, because everyone here has gone, let me have a look. And you touch it and you feel it and you do all that. I do like the pinch. The pinch is really good. And we were looking at the photo album before. You select your images and David's got a couple of snaps in there and you can actually flick it across. And just very, very user-friendly and quite intuitive, really, isn't it? That's the key to it.
That's,
as Adam says, looks stunning though, doesn't it?
if you go to the Apple website, they have a video that sort of does a tutorial about the iPhone, and it goes for about 20 minutes. And it's actually, it's quite fun. I think it was done by David Pogue or someone, one of the Apple complete zealots out there. And it's a lot of fun. He actually sits down and talks you through every function of the iPhone. And it's quite good, you know. So if you want to start salivating now, go to the Apple website, click on the iPhone link and have a look at the video. It's pretty cool.
Have you put a video on there yet? I know you've only had it for 5 hours, but have you managed to get it to talk from one machine to another and whack some video onto it, see how it goes?
I haven't actually compressed any video just yet. What I've done is I've actually streamed a lot of video either via the web or on the YouTube app. So there's a built-in YouTube application.
What's the screen resolution?
That's a very good question. I can't remember off the top of my head. But again, I think the specs are on the Apple website. It's the screen is actually a lot larger than any of the previous iPod models. So it's sort of almost double the size in terms of, well, I guess height rather than width.
And it's widescreen as well, because you turn it on a side, it's shaped like a movie screen.
Correct.
Whereas I think most of the Apple iPods with screens on them are still a sort of a squarish shape screen like an old television, so it would be better for watching the movies on and digital television, that recordings from digital television, because the screen is the same size as the picture will be.
That's correct.
What's the battery like? I know you've only, once again, had it 5 hours, but I think there's been a bit of publicity about it in the media or something like that. It's about 4 hours or something if you're watching movies or things on it?
I think the slated time is about 5 hours of continuous use if you were, say, using videos and all sorts of stuff. In standby mode, you'd probably get a lot more time, of course.
So if you're on a long car trip or you're in an aeroplane or something like that, you've got at least, you can watch a movie on it without the battery going flat.
That's right.
My only criticism of the device is that you can't actually change a battery.
No, that's right.
When I travel, when my phone goes flat, you don't often have the place to charge it, so you want to do a swap.
Yes.
And you can't swap on that. That's its only downfall, I think, in a lot of respects. And it's not on 3G.
What's the storage capacity, David?
This is an 8-gig model that at this moment in time, the iPhones themselves only go to 8 gigs, whereas the iPod Touch that we were talking about before, they can go up to 16 gig. These devices are still using sort of flash RAM, so NAND or whatever it is that they're using.
So that's not a little hard disk inside there, it's all flash.
No, so these are the first generation of iPods and iPhones that come out without a hard drive built in. Right. So,
and you didn't have any problems with iTunes, with it syncing up and working?
No, it just plugged it in, selected a playlist, said please sync, and off it went. Just
that's
copied
great.
All the files across and the album artwork and all sorts of things.
Did you need to upgrade iTunes or do anything like that?
No, it's the version of iTunes that I've got, which is 7.4.2.
Yeah, at the time.
7.4.3.
Day is it today?
Yep. Every time something goes wrong, you know, you get a vulnerability of some sort or someone works out a free way of doing something that Apple charge a lot of money for, you'll notice the next day that iTunes has been updated, and we'll stop that from working until 10 minutes later someone's realized, oh, all you have to do is just change the file name and then it works again. And that's what they've done, so...
David, thank you very much for bringing that in. Hopefully you won't get mugged in the door on the way out from the studio.
Does anyone actually know where this place is?
No, it's good. It's the reason you're here tonight, because we're in stealth.
That's right.
It's been absolutely fantastic to have a look at one of these things, all the hype that's... and I think they're a really sexy little device. A lot of people are going to buy it when they become available here early next year, I think.
We hope.
Fingers crossed. All right, you're listening to Tech Talk Radio. Back with more in a moment. Plasma TVs may be banned. Oh, my goodness.
I don't care. They will pry my plasma out of my cold, dead hand.
Microsoft issued 7 security patches in a regular update.
Yep, there's a debate as to whether by turning off the ads, you're effectively stealing the content.
What about the three of us? Hang on, give up our day jobs?
Yes, absolutely.
We could be the three amigos.
We could.
You're listening to Australia's most informative technology show, Tech Talk Radio. The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. You're listening to Andrew McComb, Dr. Ron, Graham Callaghan, and welcome to our very special guest this evening, Robert Broomhead, who's the Director of the Wireless Institute of Australia. Thank you for coming in this evening, Robert.
Thanks for that, Andrew.
Just to start off, the Wireless Institute of Australia is the world's
finest and oldest national radio society, being founded in 1910. The Wireless Institute of Australia is a member of the International Amateur Radio Union and represents all amateur radio operators in Australia to the various government bodies in this country. That's what your website says, and I reckon that sums it up pretty much.
That's right. That's what we do.
All right. 1910, that was a long time ago. I wasn't around then. I guess you weren't either. So
we're having centenary celebrations fairly
100
soon.
100 years, yeah.
That's great. Yeah, they're coming up.
What, are you going to market in some manner or form?
Yeah, we're going to have some special events on that centenary year. Usually we have things like special call signs that are can be used by the radio amateurs to mark a special event. So I imagine that there'll be some rather good things happening in that aspect, special call signs and things like that, but we can talk about call signs later, I guess.
We can. Tell me about the history of amateur radio and the Wireless Institute, really going back in that era. Like, today it's a fairly sizable organisation, it's a national organisation, but back then, how did it start?
Well, the early radio amateurs, radio experimenters, I guess we take it right back to the early days of radio, when radio broadcasting first started, and there were always people who were interested in experimenting with electronics, experimenting with radio, and actually building their own radio transmitters. And way back then, they would apply to the government regulator, as it was then. And
Who were they? We had this discussion on the show recently. I don't know whether you were listening or not. We tried to work out, it was Telecom and
the Postmaster General.
And there were all these derivatives back then. It must have been, the PMG?
Yeah, PMG, I believe, way back then. And they used to be able to obtain a experimenter's license, and with that experimenter's license, they used to be able to broadcast, build equipment and experiment broadcasting. And the interesting thing is, back then, they were allowed to broadcast music and radio programs.
So do what we're doing now.
Pretty much what we're doing now, yeah.
I'll let you in on a secret. There's 4 licensed radio amateurs in this room right now.
Crikey.
Yeah, we've let that out of the bag, haven't we? And here we are broadcasting music and entertainment and things like that. We've maybe just
the irony. The irony.
Oh, yes, it's amazing, isn't it?
So radio amateurs can't broadcast music now, Robert? No. The licenses I talked about before, way back then, we're only talking about a handful of experimenters around Australia. These days, there's about 14,000 radio amateurs around Australia, and so obviously that's grown from the small handful it was back in the early days.
I must admit, one of the things that appealed to me about the hobby was the experimentation side of things, to actually get your hands dirty, get out there and build things that you couldn't buy in a shop and experiment and have fun with friends, I think. That was one of the things which I thought was the key to getting involved in the hobby. Has that changed much?
It's moved with the times. Certainly the level of experimentation, the type of experimentation has changed. These days we don't play around with, most of us don't play around with valves and things like that, but there's been a lot of...
They bite.
They bite, indeed. But the latest buzz that everybody's starting to play with is something called SDR, or software-defined radios, and that's where you're combining computer software to actually define what the radio is, and to control the radio. There's been some smart computer ICs that have been and radio ICs that have been developed to enable people to experiment with electronics, computers and radio all together and build their own radios in software.
Well, that's a good thing, really. It mixes all the technologies together in a lot of respects, doesn't it? So you can program, build, implement and get involved.
Yeah, that's
really
right. Yeah,
it certainly highlights the diversity of the hobby. I know a lot of people have this stereotypical image in their head of someone sitting in front of a microphone talking to somebody on the other side of the world in a distant, crackly, almost science fiction-sounding tones on the radio.
Yes, white lab coats and basements and stuff like that, yeah.
And that's not the case these days, is it?
Not really, no. You get people operating from the comfort of their own homes, from the spare room in their home, or maybe their four-wheel drive out and, they're camping and stuff like that.
Well, exactly. One of the interesting talks I went to recently when I was doing some research for the show was one of the local radio clubs had a talk on a gentleman who uses amateur radio operators to help track wildlife through the forest in the preservation and monitoring of, climate change and those sort of things, making sure the little critters are living and breeding and doing what they're supposed to be doing. And you know, that's part of how the community can help out, really, isn't it?
That's right. That's that tracking of using radio transmitters to attach to, say, a bird and actually tracking them to see where their habitat resides and where their flight patterns are, etc. That's called radio tracking or radio direction finding, and that's probably one of the more popular aspects of amateur radio. As radio amateurs, people get out there and do the same thing.
You were sort of saying before you can marry computers and things like that to radio communications. Well, this is marrying four-wheel drives, the bush, and a bit of technology together. So if you like, and GPS navigation, because that's involved in a lot of these games that we all play these days. So
that's right.
If you like reading a map on one of your Palm Pilots, then this could be a good option.
Yeah, there's groups of people right around Australia that get together once a month and get out there with a hidden radio transmitter and then go chasing it in their cars and on foot.
Yes, and they call it sport.
Yes.
All right, so of recent times, the internet has sort of come along and a lot of, I guess, youth, which would have been the up-and-coming ranks into the fraternity, have probably turned their attentions to, you know, this SMS things and phones and internets and personal IRC, all that sort of stuff. Is that been a factor in amateur radio and the growth of the hobby of recent times?
Oh, I believe it has, yeah. And certainly within a number of radio groups that I'm involved with and speak to, etc., a lot of the club members, for example, would go and play with computers. In fact, a lot of radio clubs declined in numbers since the 70s when computers started to become prevalent. However, over recent years, there's been an increase in membership, an increase in numbers, and that's people who have previously been involved with radio who may still have what's called an amateur radio transmitting license. They still have one of those. They get back into the hobby again. Perhaps they've become a little jaded with the computer thing. They use computers at home, then use computers at work. They're looking for something a little different to do. Pull out the old amateur radio license, dust off the radios, and get back on the air again. And radio clubs that have seen small numbers of people have grown to hundreds and hundreds of members again.
I remember when I was coming through school and becoming interested in amateur radio, that one of the things people were experimenting with back then was what was called packet radio, which was sending data over radio networks. And
that was the early form of data communications, really, yep. Wasn't it? Analog.
Yep, and they were getting very good at sending increasingly high-speed data over radio links.
It was radio teletype before that, wasn't it?
Yep, and I had radio teletype running at my house on a little computer in the late 80s, or mid-80s, and it's that technology that's come forward and gone into the mainstream that the telecommunications companies are now using to do things like MMS messaging and data over mobile phone networks. It's all related. It goes back to that same stuff that we were experimenting with back then, doesn't it?
That's exactly right. And the stuff that you were experimenting with back then continues today, but it's been enhanced even further. People are now using it mobile in their cars with GPSs and tracking their vehicle locations and watching each other drive around.
Yep.
And
that technology will feed back into the mainstream as well. So there's that experimentation is very real and very has very real world applications.
Absolutely, yeah.
Is it a costly sort of hobby to get into?
No, not really. To buy your first amateur radio set, well, you could buy something that's a converted old taxi radio for about $50.
You're not going to rule out people based on income. Anyone can do it. You can always find something somewhere to get you involved once you've got the license.
Absolutely not.
And although you don't build your own set from a pile of valves anymore, there's your local radio club will help you modify that taxi radio or whatever it happens to be, and it becomes that experimenter's delight to get something working like
that's
that.
Right.
Well, that means radio clubs are playing a major part. How many radio clubs are there in Australia, would you say, Robert?
Oh, there's about 120, I believe.
So there's got to be one close to you somewhere out there.
Yeah, within the Melbourne suburbs, there's, I can think of about 12 that I know of around Victoria.
All right. And what about regional areas and regional parts of the country? We've got a lot of population in the southern part, so we probably have a lot of radio clubs. But what about up north?
Oh, yeah. Well, right around in the regional areas, if I perhaps give you some examples, I know that Ballarat, Bendigo, Geelong's got two. Cobram, Shepparton, all of those regional areas all have a radio club of one form or another.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So Australia-wide, how would someone go about finding their local radio club?
If they go to the Wireless Institute of Australia website. There's a section on there which entitled Clubs, and that'll give you an idea of where to find your local radio club.
And we'll make sure that address is given out again later on in the program.
And we'll put it up on our website too, so people can come and have a visit there as well. The science behind the hobby. One of the other fascinating things which I thought was, well, got me intrigued, is things like solar radiation and ionizations of certain levels in the atmosphere, which made radio signals behave in certain manners. I learnt a lot back then, and I guess that still applies to communications today. Not so much because we rely on it, but it's a bit of fun to play with the changing conditions. Where are we in the sunspot cycle these days? It must be global warming and all. Lots of sun. Yeah,
we're just coming out of what's called the bottom of the sunspot cycle at the moment.
What does that mean?
Well, bottom of a sunspot cycle means that it's not very good for what's called HF or shortwave amateur radio communications at the moment. But the good news is, over the coming years, it's going to get much, much better.
11 or 12-year cycle or something, isn't it?
That's right. That's right.
So now's a great time to get into it if you want it, because things only get better as you get...
And the word is that this sunspot cycle is going to be an absolute ripper. It's going to be better than...
Yeah, no rain, right?
That's right. Robert, all this technical stuff that you're talking about, all this mumbo-jumbo and sunspots and ionospheric things and tropospheric stuff and atmosphere and all that good business, I don't know about any of this stuff. How do I learn about it? And do I need to have a level of knowledge before I apply for a license?
Well, this is a very good question, and this is... I can just explain something that's happened over the last couple of years. As I mentioned before, I'm involved with the Wireless Institute of Australia as one of the directors. We, the Wireless Institute of Australia, negotiated with the Australian Communications and Media Authority, and after much consultation and negotiation, were pleased to announce, or the ACMA was pleased to announce, a new license. We were able to restructure the amateur radio licenses, and there was a new license came out called Foundation License.
Okay.
Now, with Foundation License, you can obtain your Foundation License over a weekend by attending a simple one-day training course.
Is that held by, like, the recognised radio clubs?
Absolutely. All the recognised radio clubs are pretty much running these training courses. Typically, it'll be run over a weekend. On the Saturday, there may be some training, and on the Sunday, they have what's called assessments. Now, with this new radio license, the good news for listeners is that it doesn't require Morse code. One of the things that happened years ago was a dropping of Morse code as a requirement to be able to operate an amateur radio station, and a lot of people saw that as being a real roadblock for them to have to learn Morse code to be able to get up on the air and play amateur radio. So the good news is no more Morse code. It's still used on air, and there's still a lot of people passionate about it, but you don't require it to get your radio license.
You don't have to not use it on a double negative or anything like that, but it's just that's part of the romantic days when ships were at sea and all that sort of stuff. Right. So,
and there were people who still play with it.
They were still enthusiastic.
Yeah. So this Foundation license, we've had it since October. We've had it, let me just quick my notes here. October 2005, it was first launched, and by October 2006, we had 1,000 new radio amateurs.
So the population grew pretty sharply just because of this new introductory license.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We've been able to turn what was a hobby which was declining in numbers to now a hobby which is actually growing in numbers. And we've got more radio amateurs on the air now than we had 5 or 6 years ago. And that's pretty exciting.
That's tremendous.
And is that any credit go to the governing body, the ACMA, for that, to allow people to do that? Because don't we have to abide by international laws, the ITU and things like that? They set the rules of minimum requirements?
They set the rules for internationally recognised requirements. So, and also for things like harmonisation of frequencies that are being used
globally, in
various countries around the world, just so that we don't have an amateur radio license here that broadcasts on some aircraft band, perhaps in another country. We all use the same frequency.
Oh, heaven forbid. That'd be tragic, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
All right, we're going to take a break, and when we return, we'll talk a little bit more about Robert. We'll touch base on the Foundation license and how you go about getting one, where to start, how complex it really is, and where you can get a syllabus and all that. And I think that's going to start at the radio club, but that'll be in just a moment.
Listening to Tech Talk Radio. Subscribing to the Tech Talk Radio podcast is so easy. It's child's play.
Podcasting's so easy, even my little brother can do it.
Step one, visit the iTunes Music Store and search for Tech Talk Radio in the podcast section. Step two, click subscribe and you're done. Now every week you'll be able to listen to Tech Talk Radio whenever, wherever and however you like. You could be mowing the lawn, on a train, in a car, on a plane, at work,
poor Carl visiting the relatives, washing the car. Pressing.
The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
And welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We're joined tonight by one of the directors of the Wireless Institute of Australia, Robert Broomhead, who's in to tell us all about amateur radio, the hobby, if you want to become involved, how easy it is to do it. And by goodness me, it's become considerably easier these days than it used to be back in the good old days. Technology's made it so. You know, we didn't have to learn about Morse code. We now no longer need to know about valves, I think, either, in the syllabus. All those sort of things have been left to history. And we just talk about the things which are current and relevant. Let's talk about the qualifications, Robert. Tell me about the actual, what do you need to know about the foundation license and the other license? Tell us about all license categories, but primarily the foundation license.
Okay. As I said before, we went to the ACMA and with their help them in restructure the licenses, or the ACMA restructured the licenses, I guess, with consultation with ourselves. The licenses have now been restructured to three pretty straightforward grades of license. There's something called Foundation, which I spoke about before, and that's the new entry-level license. That's brand new. There's something called Standard, which is, for any of the people who know anything about amateur radio, if you've heard of the old Novice license, that's what Standard is now called. It's just a standard grade license. And there's an Advanced Grade license, which is the highest level of amateur radio license you can get. And the difference between them is the different radio bands that you're allowed to transmit on and the amount of power that you're allowed to transmit with.
Okay. So in essence, you can really just get up on air with the foundation license, and that'd pretty well cover a lot of local issues anyway, just talking locally and even internationally too with a ticket like that, wouldn't it?
That's right. That's right.
Robert, if I want to move from the foundation license to standard or then standard to advanced, do I have to do more exams, or how does that work?
That's right. That's right. The radio clubs and other groups will run training, further training courses. There's also a very good online radio course for doing standard and advanced upgrades from a site called radioelectronicschool.net, www.radioelectronicschool.net, or one word. Ron runs that site, and he provides online computer-based training material for those that wish to upgrade. So that's another method of upgrading. So we have foundation, standard, and advanced. One of the things about the foundation license is it's been structured as effectively as an operating license. So we're teaching people how to operate an amateur radio and what they need to be able to do that safely and without causing harmful interference to...
And that's the key to it, really, isn't it? Yeah. You don't want to interfere with your local neighbour's telly or essential services or anything like that. So, now, the licence is like a motor car licence in a lot of respects. You apply once you successfully pass the exam, and you're issued an annual licence, which you have to pay annually. What sort of costs involved in that?
It's about...
$50 or something. $58. Yeah. So it's nothing huge.
It's not huge.
And you get a certificate or a license from the government that says you're entitled to do what you're supposed to do.
That's right.
Hang it up on the wall and you'll be proud of it.
Yeah, you get two things. You get a frame certificate saying that you've passed your foundation license. You can stick that on the wall. It's got a picture of yourself on it and just put it in a nice frame.
Wow.
And you also get your transmitting license.
Mine. Yeah. When I got mine, I was back in secondary school, and it was pretty ugly, let me tell you.
Yeah. And you also get a license as well from the ACMA, yeah. Robert.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah, the ACMA is the Australian Communications and Media Authority. Is that right? And
that's
they're the federal organisation that regulates licensing.
That's correct.
Yeah. All right. So let's talk about complexity. Okay, we've whetted someone's appetite out there, and they've sort of said, yeah, I'll give this a go because it's only a weekend of my time. And with having spent a good weekend doing this, what sort of cost is involved in that weekend, and what do they come out with at the other end?
Well, the cost of the weekend, I guess, is really a little bit up to the radio club running the training. Most radio clubs will be offering training at absolutely minimal cost or just for club membership.
So to cover the hall hire and the bickies and
tea. That's right. Look, the radio clubs are doing it because they are passionate about the hobby and they want to help other people get into the hobby. So they're not making it prohibitively expensive.
So I'm looking at $60, let's call it, license each year. I'm looking at maybe $10, maybe plus or minus for tea and bickies. What about study guides and books and things like that?
Okay. The book itself, we've produced, the Wireless Institute of Australia have produced a book called the Foundation License Manual. It's called Your Entry into Amateur Radio, the Foundation License Manual. That's available. It's got a retail price of about $18. You'll find that some radio clubs will even offer that a little bit cheaper.
It's a lovely glossy brochure here that we did because you've actually bought a few in tonight. They look terrific. And
Everything you need to know is in that book.
So you sit down there and take it to bed with you at night and read the books and learn all about it.
And it's not exactly an encyclopedia volume, isn't it? Is it? It's a manageable size.
It's an exceptionally
it's very clearly laid out.
Exactly. It's not what you call lots of small print. It's quite easy to read for those who are not that way inclined. So, and it seems to be very good pictures, good examples. The odd ad in there. So,
yeah, as you were saying before. It's a bit like a motor car license. You use that licensing when you talked about getting a motor car license. In a lot of ways, the foundation license is, in a lot of ways, like teaching somebody how to drive a motor car, because part of the training is training you how to operate the radio, where you're allowed to go, what you're allowed to do. And then part of the assessment or the examination process is to actually set up a radio and give you a bit of on-air experience and actually have the person drive a radio and make sure that they're okay with doing that.
Okay, so that was going to be my next question. How does the exam work? Is it a multiple choice? Do you have to bring your calculator and slide rule, or how does it work?
Not at all, not at all. It's a 25-question multi-choice exam paper that you sit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, multi-choice with the obvious answer will be there if you're familiar with it. And so that's quite easy to complete. And then there is a further, what we call the practical assessment, which I just described, where we actually sit you down with a little bit of radio gear and watch you set it up, have a couple of on-air contacts just to make sure that you know the procedures of operating on air. And if you're successful with that, and most people are, then you're right to go and obtain an amateur radio license.
Okay, so I've walked away from the weekend. I'm excited. I've got the big tick. How long does it take to get the certificate to go and get my own radio or be on air? What do I do? Because I'm all excited and G'd up and ready to go.
Well, and the news gets better too, because back in the old days, that used to take months of waiting. Now you can pretty much, within 2 weeks, 3 weeks, if the ACMA is a bit busy, you'll hear back from the ACMA and with a notification of your call sign, or you can check online via the ACMA website and keep an eye on the call sign register, and you'll see when your name pops up.
Okay, so you'll be told on the day that congratulations, you've passed. Now just wait for the protocol to take its place.
That's right.
Do all that.
So the whole assessment process has changed now that we're using registered and trained assessors within the radio clubs, and they're able to mark the exam papers, tell you the result. You can fill out your license application form there and then on the spot, send it all off with the money, and it's simply a matter of checking the ACMA website and seeing when your license numbers have come up.
Fantastic. All right. We have, thanks to the Wireless Institute of Australia, 5 copies of your entry into amateur radio book, what Robert's just been talking about. Now we're going to give them away to 5 listeners. So if you want to give us a call on our feedback line on 1-300-664-882 and leave a message, what we're going to do, we're going to give 2 copies to people within our radio service areas and 3 copies to the first callers through who might be listening to us outside of our radio service area. I think that's probably a fair way to go.
If you have trouble with the 1-300 number for some reason, try 03-90-12-5362. That'll go through to the same message box.
So thanks to the Wireless Institute of Australia for contributing a couple of books tonight, and hopefully that'll spawn on at least another 5 members to the amateur radio fraternity. Now, let's move on, and we'll talk about that and put the information up on our website, but let's talk a little bit about IRLP. You've got a real-world example here about what you can actually do with amateur radio, haven't you, Rob?
That's right. We talked before about HF radio, the shortwave radio, being able to talk around the world. One of the things that radio amateurs as experimenters have been able to do is link radio communications with the benefits of the internet. So combining voice over IP, which...
had to happen, didn't it?
Yeah. So we're integrating the radio networks and the internet.
That's right.
That's terrific.
And what does IRLP stand for?
Internet Radio Linking Project, IRLP.
Linking Project. Okay, so what can we do?
So I can be driving to and from my work location and talking on a what's called a VHF or a UHF radio in my car and talking to someone else around the world. And very quickly, the way that it works is that my car is talking to a radio base somewhere here locally in Melbourne, which is hooked to the internet. Voice over IP then goes around the world to another corresponding station where you've got radio base and someone else driving to their work in their car, maybe in Europe or in the UK.
That's great. No phone network, no Wi-Fi.
What about time delay? That's, to me, like, we all know VoIP sort of, you know, can be a little bit delayed, but what about all the processing? Is it pretty quick?
It's pretty quick, yeah. It's pretty quick. I've got a little handheld with me here.
This is a little device, which is, maybe a couple of $100 from the local shop.
Cost me about $2.95. That one's a brand name one. You can get the cheap ones for $99.
Okay. Here we go. Live radio, everybody.
Turn it on here. Now, if I push in... let me get the
secret code.
Our guest is consulting his list of secret codes now.
I'll use one I know here. So by simply pushing the transmit button and then dialing in on the touch keypad here, which is a bit like a telephone keypad, the number of the station that I want to connect to. I'll just do one now.
So this looks like a phone, like a handheld phone.
Here we go. We're connecting.
Oh,
it's around the world.
To note 8000, SK6B repeater, located in southwest Sweden, link on.
Okay, now if I continue now to push the talk button here on this handheld, I'll be talking to people in Sweden.
Cool. That's what about Denmark? Can we go to Denmark? We can check out the Royals.
Absolutely.
So if there are other people driving in their cars, Robert, and they're just cruising around town...
Tom, is it in Sweden?
Yeah,
they'd be close to GMT.
They would just hear you coming out their radios.
Absolutely.
So that's pretty impressive when you think about it. You've got a very small transmitter, very small indeed, and you can use that to talk to someone on the other side of the world or down the street for the cost of nothing.
But I was just going to say, Andrew, for the cost of nothing, I was going to say to Robert, but surely every time you push that... press the talk button or something, it's going to cost you 20 cents or a dollar, or you have to be on some sort of plan like you are with a mobile phone, surely?
No, it doesn't cost anything. It just costs you a yearly license fee and the $25 you probably paid to do your foundation license in the first place. So.
And that's because the people running the equipment at both ends are radio amateurs and they're enthusiasts who are doing it for the benefit of everybody else. Is that right?
That's exactly right.
One of the other things of amateur radio, which there's contests and things like that, and there's awards associated with contests. Can you tell us a little bit about what happens? Because there's a few, Memorial Day competitions, isn't there?
That's right. People sometimes get the bug for entering into contests. In fact, lots of people get into the bug of entering into contests. And that's basically where you have a designated weekend or a designated number of hours. And you absolutely go for it and try to make contact with as many other radio amateurs within a certain area as possible within a given time.
It's a great camping weekend away normally. You go and hibernate on top of a hill and take the Jenny and fill the fridge and do all those sort of things and take some good company. And I know we've all been guilty of that in this room and had some really good memorable times doing it.
Just last weekend there was a contest on the shortwave radio bands between Australia and New Zealand. So there were a lot of New Zealand radio amateurs and Australian amateurs trying to make as many contacts with each other as possible within the given time period.
A lot of fun. Just before we wrap up, I've just got a couple more questions. One would be, how is amateur radio in this country faring against amateur radio in other countries? Are we still progressively growing the ranks as like other countries are? My guess is that we are with this foundation license. And where do you see the future of amateur radio in the next few years going? We've seemed to overcome the hurdle of the internet.
One of the first countries overseas to introduce the foundation license was the UK. So over in England, they actually had a head start on us and they released their foundation license, I think it was about a year before we did. So they certainly set a great, they set off with a great pace, and also have thousands of new radiometers up on the air. We've got our foundation license. We're growing our numbers here in Australia, and we're certainly seeing growth in other countries too. Japan, amateur radio is absolutely huge in Japan.
Ah,
and,
yes.
And in the United States as well.
All right. That's terrific. Robert, thank you very much for coming in tonight, and thank you very much for leaving us a couple of books for our listeners too. So once again, if you missed it, if you want to get your foundation license, we have the book here. You need to go no further, not even to a website, except for ours maybe. What you have to do is ring us on 1300 664 882, or Dr. Ron?
03-9012-5362.
And if you're in our radio service area, we've got two books to give away to the first two callers. And if you're listening to us on the pod from further afield, not in one of our radio service areas, then there's three up for grabs. So yeah, partake. Come and get one of these fantastic books.
Just leave your contact details in the message and where we can get onto you, maybe an email address. And
We might give you a ring and have a chat to you on air and find out what your plans are.
Yeah, absolutely.
Good.
Yeah. And I'll also give you some web addresses for some of the radio clubs that are in the local service area here of this station too, so any local listeners, they can get them off your TikTok radio website.
Yeah, we do that, and naturally visit the Wireless Institute of Australia, because you've got many divisions in many states.
Well, that's the way it used to be.
Oh, boy, am I that behind the eight ball. Did you know that, Dr. Ron?
No, I thought we're in Victoria Division here. Am I showing my age, am I?
No, that's okay. A couple of years ago, we figured a better way of doing things, and we now have one National Wireless Institute of Australia that looks after all of Australia.
So you stick with us, you'll learn things, boys.
Yeah, you certainly do.
All right, fantastic. Thank you, Robert, for coming in. We'll have to do it again sometime shortly. I've actually become a bit more inspired because I haven't been very active at all recently.
Oh, thanks.
Sadly, that's all we have time for in this Tech Talk Radio Summer Series. We hope you've enjoyed this particular highlights package. Don't forget to keep an eye on the official Tech Talk Radio website, of course, techtalkradio.com.au. And our panellists have their own blogs as well. There's plenty to keep you entertained online while we're holiday making and living the high life. Of course, we'll be back same time, same place, same station next week with another Summer Series instalment. Until February, enjoy the Summer Series. I'm Dr. Ron. Bye for now.
Tech Talk Radio is brought to you each and every week by a band of dedicated professionals from within the broadcasting, IT and telecommunications industries. The team consists of executive producer and host Andrew McComb, producer Dr. Ron, panellists Sir Graham Callaghan and Mark Diggins. Our US correspondent is Lydia Davis. Production facilities are courtesy of Evolving Communications. Podcast production by Graham Callaghan. Tech Talk Radio is broadcast, recorded and streamed live to the world each and every Monday night from 8 p.m. The producers wish to thank all the stations that are taking the show, including 3WBC, 3XX, Cairns FM and 4KZ. For syndication, sponsorship and advertising, call 03 9018 9043 or visit the website techtalkradio.com.au for more information. This has been a production of Tech Talk Radio Vic and is subject to copyright and applicable laws and may not be rebroadcast without approval.
Entertaining, informative and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.